Kim Jong-un said that he would allow technical experts to observe the destruction of the Punggye-ri nuclear test facility, but then reneged on that.
So what happens next between North Korea and the United States? We'll tell you. It's Thursday, November 29th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, Indonesian investigators come out with a new report on the fatal Lion Air crash. The Chinese researcher who claims to have helped make the world's first genetically edited baby says a second pregnancy may be underway. And more deaths from more attacks in Afghanistan, all on VOA Asia. North Korea has called on members of the UN Security Council to block a Trump administration effort to discuss the country's human rights record on December 10th. North Korea's UN ambassador, Kim Song, in a letter expressed surprise and regret that the council would swim against the current trend of rapprochement over Pyongyang's pledge to denuclearize. Despite Chinese objections, the council has, for the past 4 years, discussed what a General Assembly Rights Committee called the North's longstanding and ongoing systemic, widespread, and gross violations of human rights. Last month, a UN rights investigator said nothing had changed. At the same time, the South Korean news agency Yonhap said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is willing to allow inspectors into the country's main Yongbyon nuclear complex. He's on record having offered to close the site if the U.S. takes corresponding measures. Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, told VOA's Victor Beatty a pledge to allow verification is excellent, but cautions that the U.S. and others have to be careful.
Back in early May, when Secretary Pompeo met with Kim Jong-un, I am told that Kim Jong-un said that he would allow technical experts to observe the destruction of the Punggye-ri nuclear test facility, but then reneged on that. Hopefully, what he's saying now is something he's going to do, but we'll know when it happens. And if it is, it's a good thing. It's an excellent thing.
Is it significant?
It's significant in the sense that we need to begin establishing the pattern of verification. We need to not just trust the fact that he said he did it and so it's done. We've got to have some technical verification of the various elements. The problem, though, is Yongbyon may represent probably only a third to a half of all of his nuclear production capability. If that's all we're going to get to have disabled and observed, that's not nearly enough.
Is it your view that he's already achieved the nuclear arsenal and missile capability that he wants, and really these are verification inspections that are being completed after everything's taken care of?
No, I think he's still pressing ahead hard. He does not yet have the ICBM force that I think he wants to have, so that he is in a position to coerce the United States. And, you know, that sounds really heavy-handed, but the reality is I think Kim would like to be in a position where he can tell the United States, you're done in South Korea and you need to pull out. That's not the kind of capability we want someone like Kim Jong-un to have.
Are the two sides still meeting?
I really don't know. I don't have any direct indications other than what I've seen in the media, which suggests there may be some lower-level discussions, but not higher-level ones.
South Korea reportedly plans to buy two Israeli early warning radar systems as it reinforces air defenses against the North, despite improving relations. Are the South Koreans hedging their bets about peace?
Well, sure, they're hedging their bets, but also President Moon is under incredible pressure from the national security community, and especially retired general officers, who are saying that the things that he's doing up along the DMZ and so forth are undercutting the defense of South Korea. And so what he's trying to do is to demonstrate that he's maintaining the defense of South Korea. And this includes a lot of other things, sensors to monitor the border where they've pulled guard positions out, major increase in the defense budget for this coming year. So what's ironic in South Korea is if you get a liberal or a progressive president, they increase the defense budget a lot. If you get a conservative president, they increase the defense budget only a little because they don't have to take care of their constituency. They have to appeal to the other side of the aisle.
Bruce Bennett said the past year has seen many gifts for North Korea, including summits, not pressing it on rights records, and suspending joint military exercises with South Korea. In return, he said the North has done nothing about denuclearization, not one weapon surrendered. In fact, Bennett said he continues to build up his arsenal, and now he believes President Donald Trump will begin pressing the North Korean leader. You are invited to read more on this top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. An explosion outside of a chemical plant in northeastern China killed 22 people and injured just as many in the city of Zhangjiakou. South Korea launches a single-stage rocket to test a locally made engine, part of efforts to place a satellite into orbit. A large fire devastates one of South Korea's main telecom companies, affecting millions of users. China's new construction on a remote South China Sea reef has soured its relations again with Vietnam. And torrential rain and gale force winds lash Australia's biggest city, Sydney, on Wednesday, causing commuter chaos, flooding streets, railway stations and homes, grounding flights, and leaving hundreds of people without electricity. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. We continue now. In a preliminary report issued Wednesday, Indonesian investigators said a Lion Air Boeing 737 that crashed in the Java Sea soon after taking off from Jakarta, killing all 189 people on board October 29th, was not in airworthy condition. However, the report stopped short of giving a cause for the crash. Only the flight data recorder has been retrieved, and it revealed a struggle by the pilot to bring the plane's nose up while an anti-stall device was pushing it down as he struggled to bring the plane back to the airport. The same problem plagued the crews on previous flights. The problem was reported to maintenance crews, but the plane was cleared for takeoff. The report called on Lion Air to take steps to improve its safety culture and better maintain flight logs. Jeffrey Thomas edits AirlineRatings.com in Australia. He told VOA crews on earlier flights simply turned off the air and stabilizer trim wheel, while there is no evidence the angle of attack sensor was replaced.
This is a very important aspect where anything that's changed or modified or tested must be documented accurately, and this was not done. Now, the other issue here is when the plane took off on the fatal flight, the same problem occurred, but the pilots didn't handle it properly and they didn't switch off the system that was causing the problem. It's very simple. It's a very simple switch to switch this off. And suggestions that Boeing had hidden this new system from pilots are simply incorrect. It's there in the manuals. They also briefed airlines.
We asked Thomas if this was a case of a lack of proper repair or a lack of training for the airline's pilots.
Put simply, yes, that would appear to be the case. And you know, having said that, the investigation is preliminary. That's where it's pointing, and we still don't have the cockpit voice recorder to better understand what other issues, if any, the pilots were dealing with. All 737 pilots would absolutely know. It's a memory item. You're committed to memory. You don't look up a manual. You just know it instinctively what you have to do. If you have this runaway stabilizer trim, and that's not something that's mysterious. It's a flywheel sitting right beside the two pilots, two flywheels right beside the two pilots. You can't miss it. You absolutely know if this thing's going crazy, if you like to use that term, and spinning forward, pointing the nose down, you know that you've got a runaway stabilizer trim wheel.
The Boeing 737 is the most widely used commercial airplane in the world. So this report on the Indonesian crash, he says, must be top of mind to all of the airlines that use them.
And that this is the interesting thing. There's about 7,500 737s flying around the world at the moment. And combined, they do approximately 30,000 flights a day. So if you had some inherent problem in the 737, we would have known about it decades ago. Certainly, this is a new model, and there's 200 of them flying at the moment, and it's been thoroughly tested. If you have what's called a runaway stabilizer trim for whatever reason, then you simply switch it off.
Thomas says for Indonesian aviation, this crash is particularly disturbing.
It's a major setback. You're absolutely right. And one of the disturbing things about this is it recently achieved what's called the International Air Transport Association Operational Safety Audit. It covers over 1,067 operational parameters, and it's a very rigorous audit, and they passed it. Given the performance with the handling of this particular airplane and the maintenance of it and keeping it in service, you have to scratch your head and wonder how on earth they ever passed the audit, because this is not the sort of performance you would expect from an airline that's had achieved that particular audit.
Jeffrey Thomas at Lion Air, a budget carrier, has captured half of the domestic Indonesian market after 20 years of operation with no fewer than 500 aircraft on order from Boeing and Airbus. He called this crash a significant black mark against it. A full crash report is expected sometime in the new year. Happening now in Asia, Pepsi and Coca-Cola are set to invest $1.4 billion with a B in Pakistan in coming years. A statement from Prime Minister Imran Khan's office said after executives from the two companies met with Khan. Many consumer companies see Pakistan as a hot market due to its fast-growing population, the world's sixth biggest, with 100 million people below the age of 30. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. A Chinese researcher who claims to have helped make the world's first genetically edited baby says a second pregnancy may be underway. The researcher, He Yunque of Shenzhen, revealed the possible pregnancy Wednesday while making his first public comments about his controversial work at an international conference in Hong Kong. He claims to have altered the DNA of twin girls born earlier this month to try to make them less resistant to infection with the AIDS virus. Mainstream scientists have condemned the experiment, and universities and government groups are investigating. He said the second potential pregnancy is in a very early stage and needs more time to be monitored to see if it will last. Leading scientists said there are now even more reasons to worry and more questions than answers. After he's talked, the leader of the conference called the experiment irresponsible and evidence that the scientific community had failed to regulate itself to prevent premature efforts to alter DNA. Altering DNA before or at the time of conception is highly controversial because the changes can be inherited and might harm other genes. It's banned in some countries, including the United States, except for lab research, and scientists weren't buying it at all. David Baltimore, a Nobel laureate from the California Institute of Technology and a leader of the conference, spoke at that conference after he's a parent.
It would be irresponsible to proceed with any clinical use of germline editing unless and until the safety issues have been dealt with in this broad societal consensus, basically an open process, that has not happened and that it would still be considered irresponsible.
Baltimore said the case shows there has been a failure of self-regulation by the scientific community and said the conference committee would meet and issue a statement on Thursday about the future of the field. Jennifer Doudna, University of California, Berkeley scientist and one of the inventors of the CRISPR gene editing tool that he said he used, called the situation a truly unacceptable development.
We still need to understand the motivation for the study and what the process was for informed consent and how the children will now be monitored. And I don't know the answers because we didn't hear them today.
There is no independent confirmation of He's claim, and he has not yet published in any scientific journal where it would be vetted by experts. At the conference, he failed or refused to answer many questions, including who paid for his work, how he ensured that participants understood potential risks and benefits, and why he kept his work secret until after it was done. If gene editing is ever allowed, many scientists have said it should be reserved to treat and prevent serious inherited disorders with no good alternatives, such as sickle cell anemia and Huntington's disease. Researchers said HIV is not a good fit because it can be kept under control with medications. Coming your way, multiple deadly attacks in Afghanistan. This is VOA Asia.
The news never stops,
So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Pentagon confirms Wednesday's passage of two U.S. Navy vessels through the Taiwan Strait. Reports had said that the USS Stockdale, a guided missile destroyer, and the USNS Pecos, a replenishment oiler, conducted a routine Taiwan Strait transit November 28th in accordance with international law. The Pentagon spokesman said the Navy will continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. VOA Asia continues. Afghan officials say a suicide bomber detonated a vehicle-borne bomb Wednesday evening outside a British security company's compound in Kabul, making way for a group of armed assailants to storm the facility and spark fierce gun battles. Afghan's Interior Ministry spokesman Najib Danish confirmed the raid on the high-security facility housing the G4S security group and said at least 10 people were killed and that rescue workers have moved more than a dozen injured people to the hospital. He did not discuss the number of assailants. The British company is said to be training Afghan police and providing guards for the British embassy. The Taliban claim credit for plotting the bomb and gunned assault against the robustly fortified compound along a main road in Kabul. Earlier in the day, Afghan officials and residents said clashes between government forces backed by foreign airstrikes and the Taliban in the southern Helmand province killed at least 30 civilians, along with 16 insurgents. Women and children were among the civilian casualties. And on Tuesday, a roadside bomb planted by the Taliban killed three U.S. soldiers and wounded three others, along with an American contractor near the troubled central eastern city of Ghazni. The U.S. military has lost 11 personnel in combat action in Afghanistan this year. Afghan security forces have also suffered unprecedented casualties in recent years, losing nearly 29,000 personnel since 2015. Afghan civilians, meanwhile, continue to bear the brunt of the deadly conflict amid the United Nations warnings that civil casualties have reached new highs. The evening insurgent attack in Kabul came hours after President Ashraf Ghani announced in Geneva to an international conference on Afghanistan that he's formed a 12-member team for prospective peace negotiations with the Taliban to try to end the war. But a Taliban spokesman rejected Gandhi's assertions, saying that the insurgents were not ready to talk to his government. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the conference site at the United Nations in Geneva.
2 years ago, the international community pledged more than $15 billion as part of a four-year development plan for Afghanistan. The Geneva meeting is seen as a good opportunity before the next pledging conference in 2020 to gauge progress made on the country's reform agenda. Toby Lanzer is the deputy special representative for the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. He says the conference will look at how well Afghanistan is following through on its commitment to battle corruption and make public financial management more sound.
And that people who have been engaged in corruption are brought to book, prosecuted, arrested, and put in jail if found guilty. It's the primary purpose of why we're here. And yes, I think quite naturally, the question of peace, the question of ongoing conflict.
Lanzer notes a seminal moment occurred at the end of February when Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he was ready for talks with the Taliban without preconditions. Afghan forces have been battling a Taliban insurgency which considers the government illegitimate. While new opportunities for peace have arisen, Lanzer tells VOA they will not be explored at this Geneva session.
It's a conference about development first and foremost, but we've carved out some space. Senior officials won't just be in the building attending the conference, okay? They're going to be in the sidelines, they'll be discussing matters, and I think that peace, stability, trade will be very high on their agenda.
Next year will mark the 40th anniversary of war and conflict in Afghanistan. After four decades of instability, Lanzer says most of the country has a tremendous hunger for peace. He says the international community can lend support and guidance in moves toward peace, security, trade, and development. But for them to be sustainable, he notes, these processes must be Afghan-owned and Afghan-led. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan led a groundbreaking ceremony Wednesday for a new border crossing with arch-rival India, days after New Delhi announced it would support a corridor to facilitate its minority Sikh community to visit one of their holiest sites across the border. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The art of building small wooden boats is being used to help young, at-risk adults turn their lives around. At a seaport center in Alexandria, Virginia, they're serving as apprentices in a boat-building program that gives them the skills, confidence, and discipline to change their lives for the better. VOA's Deborah Block takes us there.
Apprentice Chris Atkins is learning what it takes to build a small wooden boat.
It's been fun to learn how to use these tools.
Here at the Seaport Center on the banks of the Potomac River in Alexandria, Virginia, the small group of apprentices from 18 to 22 years old learn how to build sailboats and canoes.
Learned definitely measured twice and cut once.
Besides carpentry and mathematical skills, the 19-year-old from Florida is also learning more about himself.
This opportunity really has given me the opportunity to really dig deeper into myself and find what I want to do.
At the helm of the program is Jimmy Gottfried, who had also been an apprentice.
Many of the apprentices in our program have faced many challenges in their life, such as lack of family support, dropping out of school, having run-ins with the law. And they're looking for a way to gain back the confidence they need to go back out into the workforce.
So that you can.
The year-long program pays a small stipend. The apprentices are guided by volunteer mentors, like Fred Geiger, who teach them how to build the boats and improve their lives.
When you work with wood, you feel it, it becomes part of you. And as their self-confidence gets better, then you can start to address some other things in their lives, like are you paying your bills, are you living?
Atkins had to drop out of high school to work.
My mom died when I was 8 years old, so that's always something that's on me. And if I haven't had the support from my father, the one reason that I came to the program was because they want to help you. And I guess what is hard for me is because I'm not used to someone wanting to help me or enthusiastic about it. Or if anything would believe in me.
We'll find out. You'll get
apprentice program manager Jay Helinski is a role model for the group. He completed the program about a year ago.
And they know that I'm, you know, living proof of what hard work, dedication, and just the willpower to succeed gets you to.
When the boats are finished, they are sold at a raffle. Atkins says he will be sad to see them go. But knows, like life, they are meant to sail onward.
It's all the creativity that goes into making them. I'm glad that they're going out and they're going to a good home.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Indian security forces shot dead an alleged Pakistani militant accused in the death of a prominent journalist during a gunfight Wednesday in Indian-administered Kashmir, according to police. Javed Jatt and another accomplice were killed in a joint military-police operation in central Kashmir's Bangam district that also left three soldiers injured. Jatt is accused of killing Syed Shujat Bukhari outside his office in Srinagar, Kashmir's main city, on June 14th. Two of his police bodies guards were also killed. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks to director Tracy Carter, our engineer Dan Crafton, our managing editor Diane Gal, and our whole VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Have a wonderful day.